This is a Renewed Covenant Ministry message. Every message delivered by this ministry strives to show the relevance of the most important covenant ever revealed to God's people. The New Covenant. A covenant offering grace through faith, thereby renewing the law of God in our hearts and minds through the manifestation of the only begotten Son and eternal Word of God, in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the Son of God and Son of Man, the firstborn among many brethren. The majority of our audio messages come from our Sabbath Bible studies, delivered by Brother J.S. Lowther at a Sabbath convocation centered around the patriarchal family structure near Marietta, Ohio. Contact us by mail at Box 134, 140 Gross Street, Marietta, Ohio, 45750. Find related messages relevant to the systematic theology offered by Renewed Covenant Ministry at renewedcovenantministry.com. That's all one word, renewedcovenantministry.com. And now for the message.
All right. Well, we are going to be on our 14th part of church government. And deal particularly with Romans 13, taxation, tribute, custom, fear, honor, and all the other things that we've been talking about in certain contexts of God's law. But before we get into that, let us once again ask the Lord in the words of King David to open our eyes that we may behold wondrous things out of thy law. Because we are strangers in the earth, hide not thy commandments from us. Amen. So, oftentimes, we get used to prayers like that. And one of the reasons why people stop using them is because it becomes just something that you do, not something that you mean. Our focal texts have been, and these are going to make more impact, I think, today than they have in the past, since our two focal texts have been Exodus 20, verse 12, from the Ten Commandments, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and Leviticus 19, 32, secondarily, thou shalt rise up before the hoary head or the gray-haired man, and honor the face of the presbyter, and fear thy God, for I am Yahweh. And so, last week we covered a very seldom read part of Israelite history, concerning a war that was with Midian, the enemies of the Lord that were conquered, and how that conquering went. And so in that uncomfortable chapter in the law of God, for many people who think according to a 21st century paradigm, Numbers chapter 31 is not exactly everyday reading or contemplation or meditation. But the purpose in reading that chapter, I think, will be more understood in this study, particularly why it's important to read that. I didn't read it to just rub it in the face of modern day thinkers who would hate it, but to show the place where tribute and tax came from in the lawful government as God shows it to be. In the reality, God law directs us as his covenant people to utilize. Because as we can remember the words of 2 Timothy 3:15 through 17, that all scripture is profitable doctrine. It's supposed to be for our reproof, for our correction, for our instruction in righteousness, that the men of God may be perfect and equipped thoroughly, furnished to all good works. And so that would include Numbers chapter 31, even if people don't like it. And so when we look at the Bible today, I hope we can retain some of that thoughts, because it was that purpose that we had in looking at church government from that angle. Because whenever you first look at church government and you see how it supports the tribal family based on a nation and on a kingdom, that is how Christendom, or that is how Christian nations are to be structuring themselves. They're supposed to understand from the scriptures, from the law of God, how they structure their government and make it work in times of peace, but also in times of war. And so what we saw was how during offensive warfare this looked, because in that context, tribute was specifically being directly spoken of, and how that was given to the sanctuary, and how that tribute was taken out of times of war, how taxation in a biblical model actually looks. And so regardless of the way we think about this subject in our modern day, something to remember that just simply taking the logic that even nominal Christians would push on Romans 13, which most people would say, well, that just says pay all your taxes and be a good citizen and do everything you're told to do, that context, apply that to Numbers chapter 30 and those Midianite captives. Well, it means the same thing, is kind of the point I'm trying to make, is if you truly believe that that's what Romans 13 means, is that that it's telling you to, you know, basically just be a good conquered citizen, then you shouldn't have no problem with understanding Numbers 31 from that same angle if you were conquered by a people like that. So, with that being said, let's go back and take a peek at what Romans chapter 13 says, and then we're going to start moving our way through some other context. We'll go back to Numbers 30 for just a verse and then move our way through it. Romans chapter 13, verse 1, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resists the power resists the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation or condemnation. For rulers, that's archos, and of course defining this biblically, these are the episcopes, these are the judges, these are the fathers of the houses, these are the fathers of the kindreds, and so on and so forth, as we've covered now for 14 weeks, this being the 14th. For rulers, for the archos, are not terrors to good works, but to evil, or evil works. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power, or that power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that does evil. It's also interesting to notice that the word minister here is not the common word that you would read about priests in the Bible, which the word kohanim in Hebrew would normally or sometimes be translated minister, and that priests were the ministers of God. It's not speaking of priests. It actually uses the word diakonos, or deacon as we say it now, and it used to mean in Greek something pretty base, like a table waiter, somebody who would actually wait tables and clean up after people. And so in the case of the oikos nomos that we had talked about at the very beginning of this Bible study, it's interesting to notice that, because that was the house law keeper. Most people know oikos because I think there's a yogurt brand named oikos, which is Greek yogurt. And so it's the household yogurt, right? So oikos nomos is the Greek house lawyer. And so in this way, we're talking about God's minister, God's table waiter, attending continually on these things that are spoken of, okay? That is his job, to kind of clean up the house, to clean up the table of those he waits upon. He is God's minister, his table waiter, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that does evil. In that context, I think it makes a whole different idea of what a public servant is supposed to be, as opposed to what it's kind of become in the tyrannical society we're kind of part of now, and have been for a while now, in the way we think about it naturally. And so Romans 13:5 says, wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. So there's two reasons. You're not supposed to be subject to the archos, to the head of the house, to the minister of God, because you're afraid of being punished, but because God has put a conscience in you to honor your father and your mother, and to rise up before the face of the old man, the presbyter, and show him reverence. And so that's conscience sake. That's what it's talking about. You don't just do it because you don't want to get spanked, so to speak, as a child. All kids who've been spanked in a good, proper, godly home know what I'm talking about. You don't just do something because you don't want to get spanked, or at least you shouldn't. You should also do it because you know it's right not to do wrong. And that's pretty much the point that's being made here in the small-scale home as well as the greater-scale nation that we're dealing with. And so Romans 13:6 says, "For this cause pay ye tribute." And we're going to get into deeper discussion of this later. "For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing." And so that word tribute we'll discuss. It's phoros in the Greek, which is part of what we're going to discuss at length here later. So we'll save that. "For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing." That is wrath and conscience it's speaking of. And then it says in 7, "Render therefore to all their dues," or all that you owe them. And here's some of what is listed. "Tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom is due, fear to whom fear is due, honor to whom honor is due." We're going to get into a deeper look at those words because, unfortunately, our King James translators and most translations do not keep the same words from the New Testament and to the Old Testament and throughout the New Testament. And so you have to do a little bit of word study to keep the concepts together, sadly. And so it goes on to say this very important thing, these last statements here in these last three verses I'm going to read. "Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loveth one another hath fulfilled the law. For this," so this is added to that, "thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love works no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. And that, knowing this, the time that now is, that it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we first believed." And so we're going to stop just there for the context, and we will be going back and looking at that, but we should just read that and think about what it says a little bit. This is a hotly discussed chapter out of the Bible. It's defined many different ways, but we're going to make an attempt to continue to look at it from only the law of God and asking the question, what does this asking the Christian to do under a godly government and under the government that we find ourselves in from 2,000 years ago to today? And so someone may say, that what we read last week in Numbers chapter 31 is not a Christian model. It's not a civilized government, because civilized government would never look like what Numbers 31:28 says, which went on to tell us that the tribute being spoken of in this case here was a levied tribute unto the Lord from the men of war that went to a battle of one soul of 1/500th. Both of persons, of beeves, of asses, and sheep. That's the biblical and lawful definition of the type of tribute the law speaks of. And so the answer for Romans 13 statement, as it is wont to be spoken of by Christians when speaking of government, beside this verse in the Greek Septuagint, only Leviticus 27:23 speaks of these words, speaks of the type of tribute that's being referred to here in Romans 13:7. It's the only time that you're going to find it is Leviticus 27:23 and Numbers 31:28 and in 31's context all throughout. And so that's speaking of the dedication of fields and holy things and uses for the Levites, for the sanctuary, and different devoted items that were devoted and given a value, which we're going to talk about that some more, because Leviticus 27 really, I think, is the right way to look at Romans 13 entirely. And that would be a lot to discuss and a lot to talk about. So I'm going to kind of leave that there. We're going to hit on it throughout the study. But really, if you want to understand Romans 13 from a biblical context, you have to look at Numbers 31 and you have to look at Leviticus 27 and some other context surrounding it. So we're going to look at that as we move our way through it. And so whenever we deal with government matters, to answer the question of what the word telos is, that's the word that we're dealing with for the type of taxation that we're speaking of in both contexts. In the King James Version, it says custom, unfortunately. It does not say tribute. And so in the word custom, underneath that is the Greek word telos. And then in the ESV version, the more modern English version we read from sometimes, it's the word revenue. And then in the ABP Bible, it's just the simple word tax. Okay, telos. And so it has this provable context as to where these customs, which is what it spoke of, or these taxes, these revenues are to come from in the law of God. It comes from Numbers chapter 31, 28, and it comes from Leviticus 27, 23. That's the only places you can go in the law to really put a case together for what this would be speaking of. And so Romans chapter 13, 6 through 8 particularly. Our understanding of Romans 13 is much more a Reformed perspective along the lines of Calvin and John Knox understanding. That is that they interpreted these passages in their context in the way that we would understand them, that these laws in Romans 13, that these things that were due, these things that are lawful, are due to a godly government. They're due to a lawful government. And so we know that in the character of government, however, it's more often not the case that we have a godly and a lawful government. As a matter of fact, I think you can even look back at times when we had good governments in history, and that they had some pretty bad laws that they pushed that were unchristian. And so hindsight's always 20/20, and when we look back at it, we go, ooh, I'm glad I didn't live then, because they just burnt you if you did that, you know, and that sort of thing. And so we always can find faults in other governments. But even when we look at the best laws and the best governments, we have to understand that it's always the duty of the people to try to reform the government back to a godly government and to press the idea that Romans chapter 13 is not dealing with bad government. There's a place in it for bad government, but it is dealing primarily with a godly government. And so, as it says, for this cause pay ye tribute, for they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing, noticing they're God's ministers. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom is due, fear to whom fear is due, and honor to whom honor is due. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loves one another has fulfilled the law. We obviously realize that what we're dealing with is one who's God's minister. And so what would all of these words look like in a biblical context, I think, is the way I'm going to end this in showing from the law what it is that it could be speaking of, if I'm correct, and looking at this law in the Septuagint understanding of it. And so in Romans 13:7, it says render. First word to notice. Render, what's that mean? It means apodote. Give away, to give. Doesn't say be taken from. It says render, give. Therefore, to all their dues. Other translations say debts. Other translations say what is owed. And what is owed, I think, is the exact meaning of ophile, which is the word for owe or debt or dues here. And so here's one place in the law where the word ophile is translated in the King James Version, dues, in respect to giving one what is owed unto them. And there's one place in the Septuagint, only one in the Septuagint, where that is spoken of, and that's in Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 2. It's nice when there's only one place in the law, because then you feel pretty confident that that must be the context. And here's what it says. Now, remember, biblical government's family government. This is the ordinance of the release. Thou shalt remit every private debt which your neighbor owes, ophile, owes thee. Thou shalt not ask payment of it from thy brother. For it has been called a release to the Lord your God. I'm reading out of the Brenton Septuagint. Of a stranger you shall ask again, whatsoever he has of yours. But to your brother you shall remit his debts to thee. I think we're seeing a little context build up there. For thus there shall not be a poor person in the midst of thee, speaking to Israel, for the Lord thy God will surely bless thee in the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee by inheritance, that thou should inherit it. And if ye shall indeed hearken to the voice of the Lord your God to keep and do all these commandments, as many as I charge thee this day, for the Lord thy God has blessed thee in the way which he has spoken to thee, then thou shalt lend to many nations, but thou shalt not borrow. Thou shalt rule Arkas over many nations, but they shall not rule over thee. And if there shall be in the midst of thee a poor man of your brethren, of one of the cities in your land, neighbor, that's why it's saying that, cities in your land, he's your neighbor, which the Lord thy God gives thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart, neither shalt thou by any means close up thine hand from thy brother who is want. Thou shalt surely open thine hand to him, and shall lend unto him as much as he wants, according to his need. Take heed to thyself, that there be not a secret thing in your heart, an iniquity, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, draws nigh, and your eye be evil toward your brother that is in want, and thou shalt not give to him, and he shall cry against thee to Yahweh, and there shall be great sin in thee. Thou shalt surely give to him. Thou shalt lend him as much as he wants, according as he is in need. No, it's always captioned by his need. You can't just say, give me all you got. And thou shalt not grudge in thine heart as thou givest to him. Because on this account the Lord thy God will bless thee in all of your works, and in all things on which thou shalt lay thy hand. For the poor shall not fail off of the land, therefore I charge thee to do this thing, saying, thou shalt surely open thine hands to your poor brother, and to him that is distressed upon the land. Notice, upon the land. Remember the ending of the fifth commandment. If thy brother or sister, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, be sold to thee, he shall serve thee 6 years, and in the seventh year thou shalt send him out free. And when thou shalt send him out free from thee, thou shalt not send him out empty. Thou shalt give him provisions for the way from your flock, from your corn, from your wine, as Yahweh thy God has blessed thee, thou shalt give to him. I'm going to end reading there. Notice that at the end, it even tells the master that he is to send him out with something so that, of course, he's not poor immediately and has to come back and say, I'm poor again, because, well, that would kind of go against the whole problem there that was trying to be resolved. But we should notice this, that when we are speaking and strictly defining the dues or the debts that are in the context of Romans 13 that are owed at law, it is for a course of 6 years. You would need a judge to determine these things, a head of a family, to determine some of this stuff. And that's why I said Leviticus 27 would greatly help in considering those estimations and values of certain things. Notice also this is in regards to kinsmen and kinsmen redemption, in regards to a master-servant relationship, a Hebrew servant or an Israelite servant, a tribal brother, a kindred neighbor, we could call it, of one of your own cities, and that who is near to you. So thus, he would be within one of your units, either a unit of 10, 50, 100, 1,000, thousands, whatever. Or he could just be from a whole other tribe, if he's a Hebrew or an Israelite. And so the point of the matter is that there is an admonition of brotherly and neighborly love, right in the context of Romans chapter 13, that owe no man anything but to love one another. For he that loves another has fulfilled the law. And so I think it's pretty straightforward to see. I don't even think I need to explain how Deuteronomy chapter 15, that's Deuteronomy, right? Not Numbers. Yeah. Deuteronomy chapter 15 speaks of brotherly love. I don't think I have to go out of my way to make that point abundantly clear. And so that's the first thing. Owe no man. And what you do owe a person, you need to pay them. So when a person borrows from you, you are supposed to intentionally try to pay them back, is the whole admonition. But the whole context of when man can't pay you back and how this whole thing works is all based in brotherly love. But you would need a family judge to determine such things. So you better owe, you know, you better give someone what is due to them, is the point. Custom to whom custom is due. This is phoros in the Greek. This is phoros. This is the tribute specifically that we have been dealing with. This is the tribute, while the telos is the custom of the, or is the tax of the next line. I know it gets confusing because of the language of the King James. But this is the phoros tax. And so I'm going to give a few examples of phoros. Judges 1:28. It came to pass when Israel was strong that he made the Canaanites tributaries, phoros, but he did not utterly drive them out. The stranger is made a tributary to Israel. They were supposed to be utterly wiped out, but they didn't. Instead, they resorted to making them tributaries. 1 Kings 12:18 says, King Solomon sent Adoniram, who was over the tribute, the phoros, customs. But they stoned him with stones and he died. And King Rehoboam made haste to rise to flee to Jerusalem. I'm sorry. Solomon made Adoniram the head of the tribute, and Rehoboam uses him to try to collect tribute more than even what Solomon wanted out of him. And so, again, here's a good question. Of whom do the kings of the earth pay tribute? In census, the strangers. What did the Israelites do when their government tried to exact something from them like they were strangers? They killed the tax collector. It kind of shows you the mentality, though, that was in the people at that time. And so while we see what happens to the king's men when they attempt to take the sons of the nation and reduce them to strangers, at that time in Israel's history, they just weren't going to put up with it. We know also from 1 Kings 9:20 through 22 that all the people that were left of the Canaanites, which were not of the children of Israel, their children that were left after them in the land, whom the children of Israel also were not able to utterly destroy, upon those did Solomon levy a tribute. There's what we're talking about. And he made them bond servants unto this day. But of the children of Israel, Solomon made them not bondmen. So you see, in Solomon's day, no one was made to pay a tribute. They're not bondmen. But they were men of war, it says. They were the warriors. They were the 20 years old and upward men of war. And they were his servants and his princes, his captains, the rulers of the chariots and of the horsemen. So we see Israel having a warfare status at the beginning of the Israelite kingdom. And so this tribute, wherein the strangers were compelled to serve and to give tribute, which was refused by the Israelites, would have most likely been what was talked about in this case, that they were the strangers that were being levied, having the tribute levied upon them, and that the Israelites were even unwilling to allow that to take place anymore, that they were not interested in the king treating anybody in the land that way anymore, any longer. So I think that that's pretty interesting. So in this case, one who is under tribute is to give his tribute as a conquered captive. That's kind of the point. And so if your lot is a conquered captive in this biblical society, what are you being asked to do? Give what is due. Give what you are supposed to. And so that's why at the beginning of this I said our example in Numbers 31 would not be exempt from this idea. And so then it says custom to whom custom is due. And we had already covered that at pretty great length in Numbers 31 example. This was the word telos. It's the word telos in Romans. And it is of the souls, the beeves, the asses, and so on and so forth, that were taken in combat, given to the episcopes of the host. And of that, there was a portion taken, 1/500 and given, and then 1/50 of others. And so I don't think that we probably have to focus much on fear, to whom fear is due, because that seems to be pretty easily summarized in Leviticus 19:3, which we've already read. Ye shall fear every man, his mother, and his father, and keep my Sabbaths, because I am Yahweh your God. So the fear of parents and the fear of Yahweh is to whom fear is due. And what of honor to whom honor is due? Interestingly enough, this word is timē. It's the word used to speak of value in the law. This is the word you will find all throughout Leviticus 27, 1 through 34, the whole chapter, in making an estimation of value of things, to understand what something's worth. Some things in biblical law that were to be given as a offering or were to be dedicated or were to be considered holy things had to have a value assigned to them in silver. And so what people would do is they would have a scale to understand what something was valued by. And while you could understand this as just simple honor, it's not the word for honor thy father and thy mother, so that would have been an easy explanation, but unfortunately that's not it. And it's not the same word for the type of valuing that we have been talking about, but rather this is a idea of an estimation, of a assignment of value that is given to something because of what it's worth. And so some things would have a fifth part of a shekel added to the price, or a fifth part of the principal added to the price of a thing when it needed to be paid or it couldn't be paid. Some things, such as the firstlings of flocks and herds and things like that, could be redeemed. And other things could not be redeemed, and so they would be killed and burnt for the Lord or whatever the situation handled. And so there was obviously a church government that was set up so that what was due, what honor or what valuable thing was due, would be known how much it was due by the oversight, by the judges, by the archos, by the godly minister who's cleaning up the table of the mess of the people on behalf of God. He's the minister of God, attending on the things that are good. And so I think this final word right here, that is translated honor, honor to whom honor is due, timē, could in fact render the whole of the statements that is spoken of in the context of Leviticus 27:1. And you definitely see this, Ananias and Sapphira, for instance, in Acts 5:2, shows us where they sold their stuff and brought the value of it to Peter, and things didn't go well for them. They got struck dead for lying to the Holy Spirit, thinking they could get away with it. And so we see that type of thing happening in the early church. We see that men were selling their things, having an estimation of value taken of it, and bringing that money to the church to help support the church and the church government. And so we do see situations that could render Romans 13 entirely speaking of what a church government would estimate and value of a thing that belongs to the Lord, even when there was no Levitical system in place anymore, or even when the system was in place. Regardless of how that would work, you would have a system set up to know how much the Lord was to get of it. And so I think that that's important. But I think that the most important thing to notice is verse 8 again. Owe no man, which is again our same Greek word to give your dues. Owe no man anything but to love one another. For he that loves one another has fulfilled the law. And while that doesn't say, well, as long as you got this ooey-gooey feeling in your heart that we call love, then you don't have to do anything else. What it actually means is that you don't owe anyone more than what it is that the love of God drives you to do. And these things should be given from your heart because of the love of God. And as much as it is in keeping the commandments, and you're going to need a judge for keeping all the commandments that were mentioned, adultery and covetousness and all these things, you're also going to need a judge who's going to be able to tell you what it is that you should give, what it is that is right, and what it is that is just. You need a magistrate in the family that's going to help keep a family order involved. And so that's what I think that these verses are specifically talking about. And while I understand that there is a case to be made that these could be talking about Israel or the church, Christians, when they have been enslaved by a foreign power because they have been godless. God in the same way says, serve them, build your houses, plant your vineyards, you're being punished. Pay them the taxes because this is the punishment that I'm going to impose on you as slaves. Because you have not listened to me and put my government in place, then I will tell you what you will do, and it will be by force. And so there is a case to be made that says those who are punished by God, by the powers that are ordained by God, should recognize there's a time to be punished. And I think that that's something that you can't relieve from it, but the question is, in a biblical context, is what I'm asking. What does Romans 13 mean in a biblical context, not in a wicked context? It is this concept that's expressed when our Lord taught Simon Peter, the disciple who was a fisherman, this very idea, some of the very ideas we studied in Numbers chapter 31. Let's go to Matthew 17, 24, and we're going to get a lesson from our Lord on another subject. It says, when they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the two drachma tax went up to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the tax? He said, yes. And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, what do you think, Simon? Listen to this. This is, I'm reading out of the ESV. But what do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others? Good question. We should all think about it this way. And when he said, from others, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast in your hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open his mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for you. And so if you remember, the poll tax was a half shekel apiece. So we're seeing a little bit of what's going on there. You see, the rule of law says that the sons of Israel, as we had read in the past, out of Exodus chapter 30, are to give the half shekel, or in this verse, the two drachma, which apparently is the value according to anything you read in history, you look it up, two drachma was a weight that was equivalent to the half shekel at this time in history. And so we know the sons of Israel, when they were 20 years old, men of war, they gave a half shekel or two drachma in silver voluntarily, but by submission of a son to his father, to his father's house, and then from his father's house it would be given eventually to the sanctuary. Remember, it's obvious that the tax here spoken of is called the poll tax. That's one of the names that we've given it historically. In Exodus 30:12, just as a refresher, we can see what is comprehended in verse 17:25 of what we read here. As the King James word for tribute, which is in all of our King James, though I read out of the ESV, is the Latin Greek word census. That should sound pretty modern to us because it means the same thing now as what it meant in Jesus' day, only it's spelled with a K in Greek. Census. And so, just as we say it today, census, it means exactly what it means now as it did in Rome. And so, in Rome's ancestors' law, that is an Israelite law, in Exodus 30 verse 12, they got this standard that they eventually perverted, which said, the sum of the children of Israel, after their number, everyone that passes among them that are numbered, half a shekel after the shekel of the sanctuary. But the Romans, in their civil taking of the census, did not apply this tax as the Bible law does, because they were what we call apostates. They had walked away from the faith, they worshipped false gods now, and they had added to this law multiple other reasonings outside of Scripture. And so, rather, they applied the law as followed, according to Noah Webster in this time. Noah Webster speaks of the census historically this way. It says, in ancient Rome, an authentic declaration was made before the censor, or the censors, by the citizens, and their names and place of abode. This declaration was registered and contained an enumeration of all of their lands, their estates, their quantity and their quality, with the wives, the children, the domestics, the tenants, the slaves of each citizen. Hence the word signifies the enumeration, thus why we're saying it's derived from biblical law, the numbering of the people, or the register, a man's whole substance, and the tax imposed according to what each man's property was. See, they didn't tax them based on one poll tax of one half shekel for a man. Instead, this type of census that's referred to in Roman times, as Judea was under Roman rule at the time, they were slaves to Rome, in a sense, servants, meant something totally different to the Romans. They taxed all their property. And if you noticed, this census is not done before the tabernacle, not by a holy priest, because Rome had no tabernacle. They had a state which was a tyrant, and it was vested with the godhead of the nation, Caesar. And the people and the empire had a combination of sanctuary and state. And so in the eyes of the people, Caesar was a godman. He was to be worshipped. So he could tell you what to do if he wanted to because, well, he's God. And so when that kind of law is... So who does Caesar appoint to take the census? Well, according to what we just read, the censor came and took the census. He was the one who took the tax. It says it was given to a censor. It's defined this way. He's an officer in ancient Rome whose business was to register the effects of the citizens to impose taxes according to the property which each man possessed, and to inspect the manners, notice that, this man also inspected the manners of the citizens, with power to censure vice and immorality, according to his law. This man could also censor vice and immorality by inflicting a public mark of ignominy on the offender. So, when this censor came and found you offending, or not doing what you were supposed to do, or not paying what you're supposed to do, he actually could put a public mark on you, so everybody knew you were one of them. It didn't walk orderly. And that's exactly what was done in ancient Rome to Christians at times. And so, do you then see the next related word that we read? Censure. An inspector of the manners of the citizens with power to censure vice and immorality by inflicting his public mark. This is the Roman, quote-unquote, priest of the state godhead. You can see what happens in an apostate form of God's law. This law very much resembles God's law. Who else would it be that would teach the people manners and customs and teach them what they should do according to the law and censor them, right? But what we have is a completely apostate form of the law of God. And so this teaches us a lesson, just looking at this one word that Jesus is speaking about in Matthew 17, census, of whom do the kings of the earth take their tribute, taxes, and their census? Gives us a very interesting glimpse into how all of this falls apart whenever the people are not scrupulously following the word of God that's able to correct and reprove and instruct and all that kind of stuff, because it takes Romans 13 as we read it and it changes it into a whole different direction. It makes it tyrannical. Whenever you take the law of Moses and apply it to government, and you change it even the slightest bit, it takes a government that serves the people as public servants, as table keepers of their families and of their clans, of their kindreds, of their tribes, and instead it makes a tyrant out of him, for he has to rule with rigor. It's taking a free people, free men, and makes them slaves. Because if you remember, the law of the Bible, the people gave willingly of themselves. They didn't have people come and collect from them, knock on their doors. And so notice the law of Israel and Judea at this time had been slightly changed just a little bit if you pay attention to the details of that language. It has been slightly changed by the abandonment or disregard of the voluntary status of giving, so that what it says is that they received tribute money. They came to Peter and said, "Doth not your master pay the tax of tribute, the 2 drachmas? Which, interestingly enough, that 2 drachmas in the Septuagint is exactly how Exodus 30:13 is translated. It actually uses the word 2 drachmas in the Septuagint translation. So we're definitely not off our rocker making those connections. That is what's being dealt with. And so the half shekel law, or the so-called poll tax that we had focused on already, was voluntary. It was given from children at 20 years old and upward to the heads of the family, to the head of the unit who gave it to his head, and it eventually ended in the sanctuary. And that, interestingly, the word telos is the Greek word for to end a matter. And it's also the word for a tax. It ends the matter. And so all givings eventually ended in the sanctuary. They ended at the Lord's house. That was kind of the idea. They did not end maintaining government just to maintain government. They ended at holy worship. And so just in that sentiment alone, you can kind of see where biblical law focuses itself. But this is not what Jesus' world looked like. Jesus' world didn't look like Exodus 30 as we read it, because what we just read is an inconsistency in Peter's response to the payment with that of what Christ's response was. See, Christ knew their law perfectly. And so Peter, not a master of the law, contradicts Jesus in a sense when he speaks to the men who came to him. While Jesus, the master, then teaches the lesson of the difference in the law that is cited in Numbers 31 about warfare and the difference between the law in Exodus chapter 30, saying, "What do you think, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take tribute or census? Do they take it from their own children, from their kin? Or do they take it from the strangers they've conquered?" That's his idea. "Of whom do the kings of the earth take tribute or census? Of their own children or of strangers?" 26, Peter says, saith unto him, "Of strangers." Peter knows the answer. And Jesus said to him, "Then are the children free." But what he finishes off with saying is, "Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go to the sea, cast them in a hook, and take up the first fish that cometh up. When thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money. Take and give it unto them for me and for thee." And so the stater, which was the money that was a shekel at that time, size of a shekel, was equal in weight. And so Christ says, "Take it, give one to them, and it will be enough for both of us, not to offend them." And it's interesting also to notice that every man was supposed to give his half shekel, not give one shekel together to represent them both. So you can see Christ not offending them according to their interpretation of the law, but at the same time, he's not endorsing the way that they keep the law, as they have been Romanized just a little bit in their understandings of how, quote-unquote, tax is taken. And so, such a simple lesson that's so hard to get, Jesus teaches in the form of a question. And so how often do we hear Christians propagate a tax that is taken and not given? Pretty often. That's pretty much the normal. Most people don't even think taxes ever were voluntary. And even in this country, in the United States, and in Europe, and in England, tax was always a given thing when people were righteous. But as soon as people are not righteous, we throw you off your land, and we dispossess you because you aren't children, you're strangers. We should remember, every time we hear from a Christian about these things, we should remember this question that we should ask ourselves and maybe even ask the Christian that we're talking to. We should just ask simply in Jesus' words, "Of whom do the kings or the rulers of the earth take tribute and census? Of their own children or of strangers?" At that point, you've already lost them, sadly. because people don't think in biblical categories of thought. We don't think of children and strangers. We just think of people that get taxed, things. But in Jesus' own words, that's a great question to ask a person. And the biblical answer is of strangers. That's the biblical answer. And so Jesus' lesson should resound in our ears. We should be able to think of that. Then are the children free. When the strangers are forced to pay the tribute, then the children are free. Then the land is free. Then the land is owned by the children. Then are the children of the kingdom free. But when it is reversed, the children of the kingdom are the ones who are made strangers, even if they are, quote unquote, in their own land. The judge of a godly society is to balance what they know by this concept. Children pay the patriarchy and the headship above them by their honor, by their obedience, by their value, because they value them, because we value our parentage, which should go back all the way to our first studies on this subject, and our sanctuary, because we value the way we worship, we give. Not because a king levies a fee or a ruler forces us to pay something, or a father forces you to pay something, or an elder forces you to pay something, but because we are children of the kingdom, in fact, and our king's law is in our heart, and therefore we give from the heart. This was and is the full lesson in our day and age of all that we've discussed, I think. I think that that's something that we can entirely take away from this Bible study. Of all that we've discussed, I think that what Jesus says right here really can help summarize a lot of what we've been discussing. I think it can summarize a lot of what we read in Romans 13, as we'll continue discussing also. And I think much more can be added to it, much more can be elaborated on it, but this I want to leave off on. I want, as we wind down, to consider those words. Regardless of if you agree with me or not on how the system comes up to us out of the law of God, here's the gist of the matter. The type of government the children of the kingdom are to desire to live under. It's going to look way more like what we've been studying than what we've got today and what we've had in a long time. It was such a desire that while I don't agree with all the systems that we have out of history that people have tried to enact, the one thing that I can definitely say, while they didn't integrate the sanctuary understandings into it and certain other things in a historical look at all of this, they still understood that land for the children was an untaxed item. There was a time, believe it or not, in America where there was no property taxes that would be paid. And that resembled more the law of God. People could not be forced off of their land because they were the children of the land. The only tax that was taxed was on commercial items. It was called an excise tax, other than the poll tax that some places had that went towards education and military and other things like that. But the excise tax was a tax imposed on people who traded with our country, the strangers. It was a tax that was traded on commerce to make money off of those who wanted to sell us things. And so you cannot deny that in the early parts of American history and other European nations that tried to reform their civil government by the law of God saw this clearly and changed it and started to make changes in that direction. And so their system understood the danger of making citizens subject to the state because they knew it would render the citizens as strangers. And once citizens or the children of a land and of a people that conquered a land become the strangers, they don't have a vested interest anymore in protecting themselves. They think it's someone else's job because they're just strangers. It's not their job to protect their country. So I think our Christian aim can be summarized, as again we're winding down in this study, for this particular look at it, is number one, what I'm hoping we can get out of just looking at these texts, if we can kind of get through our 21st century paradigm of saying, ooh, Numbers 31 is horrible, and Exodus 30 don't make sense to me because I just don't know the law very well or something. What I want to bring out of it is this. Number one, a support of the law of God in returning back to a patriarchal, voluntary poll tax of all sons of Israel, all Christian children from 20 years old and upward that are able to go forth to war in Christian families and churches. That's the first thing I hope by bringing this subject matter out that people will recognize. We have no episcopates in our families. We have no one that's accountable to anyone, and we do not reckon ourselves children of anyone. Men's sons run off and don't take care of the family. They don't take care of grandparents. They don't take care of anyone. They're their own people. They're strangers to their own families. And so what I'm hoping this Bible study will help people with understanding, and that people abroad can understand from the way the Scripture reads, is that patriarchal families need to reinstitute a voluntary head tax, a poll tax, from 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war, and they need to understand that that is what it's for. Just in concept. Okay? I don't care if you buy him a rifle. Buy your 20-year-old son a rifle whenever he gives you his poll tax, if you take his piece of silver, and give him a rifle in response. Maybe that's the best way to go about it. But the point of the matter is that men aren't being taught to be men, and they don't know what their responsibilities are in families, because people don't teach this stuff. Okay? Churches need to reform back to understanding how a patriarchal government works in their church before they even contemplate what a biblical government looks like in a whole nation. Secondly, the voluntary and the free will offering of what God has given each of us should be given to kingdom ministers. And I'm not telling you who that is or who that needs to go to. Particularly, it should be going to heads of households, should be going to presbyters, should be going to the bishops or episcopates of the family. But if there are men who are also playing the part of, we'll say, the prophet, who went around to the cities of Israel, the evangelist, like Paul and other men in that time frame, and who were trying to build biblical systems and teach men biblical systems, that free will offerings, it has nothing to do with any of the tax, nothing to do with any of the tribute, nothing to do with any of the customs we're talking about, nothing to do with tithe, free will. Whatever a man can give, he should be giving to help build these systems by faithful people who are teaching to build them. Not men who are building themselves in their own personal ministries. Not that. Not men that are building huge mega churches. Men who are empowering families, Christian families, to be Christian families. That's my second goal in talking about this. And that would come from what we had talked about if we would actually read Leviticus chapter 27, which would take a little bit of head knowledge to understand how I'm applying it and understand that the value that needs to be determined is going to need to be determined by someone, and there is an estimation that needs to be made of what you have and what you should give that should be going to help build the temple. If you remember in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, the goal was to build the temple of the Lord. Even the king commissioned him to do it because he was such a faithful servant. And so you can't say you owe me the tithe to build something that requires the tithe. The law speaks as if the law is established. The law doesn't speak as if the law has been taken apart because God's angry and he's destroyed it. So the point is a free will offering is what is given in order to rebuild the temple in the kingdom. That has to come from faithful, willing hearts. It has to come from the children of the kingdom who desire to be children of the kingdom, who want to be the children and not the strangers. That's where it comes from. Third thing that I'm hoping to get across in these messages is to remember the lesson of being a stumbling block that Jesus just taught us out of Matthew 17. Not being a stumbling block, I should say. To those who are ignorant to God's law, especially those who are learnedly ignorant and not knowing of the context. Believe it or not, there are many preachers out there, there are many theologians out there, many seminarians out there who have been taught something completely wrong and have no clue what we're talking about when we talk about this part of the law of God as it applies to a theonomy. And so there may come a time where a person may say, well, you owe the preacher the tithe, which I don't believe anyone owes a preacher a tithe. But if you belong to a church that gives a tithe, a 10%, and that's how they understand it, the Lord will provide, even if it's out of a fish's mouth, to give you the amount needed to cover that to help build the kingdom. It's kind of the point, while I'm not agreeing with the context. And so you don't want to be a stumbling block to your church who may be ignorant of these particular points that come out of the law of God as to what is owed and what is not owed, and what is to be done and not to be done. But just as, you know, Peter had a mentality of a stranger of his own ethnic nation. He thought, I must pay this because I am like a stranger. Subconsciously, he thought that way. But he had the jurisprudence, he had the knowledge of God's law and justice to answer the question rightly, recognizing himself as a stranger while knowing how the law was to function to some extent. But the collectors, the guys who were appointed over this collection of the money, they actually had no knowledge that they were doing anything wrong, most likely. And so Jesus says, don't put a stumbling block in front of them, go and pay. Because if you put a stumbling block in front of them, it's not going to aid anything. It's not going to aid our efforts, Peter. So in fact, the collectors or the censors would have believed by their pseudo-lawful practices. It was sort of like the law, but kind of not like the law. It had a little Roman law mixed in there. That they were doing God's work, that they were enforcing the law of God, in fact, by collecting and exacting the tribute according to the law. That's what they thought they were doing, most likely. But as our Lord teaches us, we are not to be an offense on this wise. And so I'm not extending this out any further than the concept goes in Matthew 17. But the Lord tells us that he will provide all of our needs by his providence when we are seeking to not cause our brothers to stumble and we're desiring to do what is right and good. And so what's he give us the example of? Go catch a fish and you'll find the money. It's kind of like Jesus' way of saying, I can control everything. I can make anything happen if I want. This money is nothing to me. Go get it out of a fish's mouth. I'll show you. And so that was the way in which he chose to speak of it. And so I think next week we're going to probably end off with this study. We're going to wrap it up.
This is Holy News Covenant Ministry.